Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. I gotta tell you something, people. The gentleman on my show today, I actually saw him at the Universal Amphitheater in August of 2001 with the Ringo Starr All-Star Band. And I remember when he sang Cleveland Rocks, Drew Carey ran out and sang with him, and the place went nuts, and it was just a great show, and I've been a fan of his for a long time, and his new album, Defiance, Part 2, Fiction, is great. In fact, I've been singing the chorus from Precious, it'll only take a minute, all week, and my guest is Ian Hunter. How you doing, Ian?
I'm all right, thanks.
So, let's talk about the new album, man. You know, it's Part 2. Now, you did Part 1 when the pandemic had just come to the close. Had just started, right?
Yeah.
So what made you decide to do that album during the pandemic?
There's nothing else to do. Came off the road, did some shows in New York, and came off the road, and I got tinnitus really bad and the pandemic at the same time. So, you know, you want to do something to take your mind off things. And bit lazy that way, but I went down and I started working on stuff. And at the same time, my manager, Russ Halfin, who's a photographer, started telling me these people would like to play because they were sitting home doing nothing, you know. Touring was off, you know, nobody was touring. And my band didn't have home studios, these guys did. And so it started off with Slash and Billy Gibbons. And slowly this whole idea formed of doing this. I was writing as I went, you know, and the more people got involved, the more inspired you get, you know.
Now how did that make you feel as an artist when you have all these people reaching out to you? I mean, it must have been very touching to you. Like all of a sudden these people were like, we want to work with Ian Hunter.
I didn't really know half of them knew me, to be honest with you. Yeah, it was great. And what it did was, it inspired you to continue on, you know. And it developed over 2001, 2002. And I wrote a lot more than I normally would. Sometimes I had a few years off, and so I'm not a permanent rocker, you know what I mean? I stop now and again because it doesn't come all the time. I'm not one of the guys that, you know, tour record. But this time around, I got lucky, you know. I mean, it was 23 songs in 24 months, something like that.
Now, you know, you said you're not someone who doesn't write all the time, but how has your writing changed over the years? Because you've done so many solo albums, you know, you wrote with Mott the Hoople, you've been performing for a long time. Have you noticed a shift in your writing process and what you write about? I mean, as we get older, we mature, so I think our ideas expand. But what have you noticed about your writing process?
I've never even thought about it. It's always been what's happening at the time and my reaction to it, right from the beginning. Whatever was going on at the time, how it hit me, and that's what you just wrote about. So yeah. As far as advancing my writing or anything like that, no. It's just, you know, songs about where I was at that time.
Now, with the first Defiance album, it was during the pandemic, so I'm sure you had to put some thought in. I read somewhere that you said you didn't want it to be anything depressing. So when you sat down, did you think in your mind that, you know, these have to be upbeat, or what was your goal?
I was semi in my mind, you know. I mean, it's bad enough, and I've got this tinnitus as well, so I'm like, need a bit of cheerfulness around here, you know. But it's kind of difficult with the situation being what it is at the moment. So I would imagine Part 2 is slightly denser, you know. It sort of gets to you after a while, the stupidity of it all, you know.
Well, you know, as I said, I've listened to the album. I really enjoy it. I want, you know, it ends with Hope. I want you to tell me more about the song Hope, because it has a good message, and it's nice to listen to. But did you go in there consciously writing, you know, about the title, or how did you create that song?
No, they kind of come. I mean, I would imagine I was probably looking in that direction because the album's kind of, you know, dense. But it came naturally, you know. All the best ones come, the ones I like anyway, they just sort of come. You know, you're sitting down there playing the piano or you're playing the guitar and there's a kind of a melody starts up where you get a line, a lyrical line, and it goes from there. Frankly, I don't have that much to do with it. It just comes, you know.
Isn't that amazing? I do stand-up comedy, and the same thing's for jokes. You know, they sit there, and I can't sit down and just write something. It just pops in your head, and you always sit there and go, I have to remember this, else I'm going to wake up the next morning, and it's going to be gone. And it's funny how some of us work like that. What do you think that is? Is it just our subconscious always thinking, or what do you think it is? Because you seem like that type of person also, that you just don't sit down and you don't look to labor over work.
No. I remember I was talking to Roger Taylor once out of Queen, and I said, how long do you go in the studio? Because I was going in the studio every day, about 4 hours in an afternoon, you know, in my home studio. And Roger said 11 minutes. He said, anything you're going to get in the first 11 minutes. And that never left me. Yeah, I mean, you've got to be aware. Your antenna's got to be up. Same for you. You know, with jokes. I mean, you've got to be, your antenna's got to be up. And if there's anything around, you catch it. And the difference between me and you is you catch it your way, and I catch it my way.
And I'm always in awe of songwriters, because you guys just you encompass so much. For me, it's just like, oh, it's one idea. But when did you start writing music? Were you a young? Did you write as a child, or when did you know that you could write songs?
The first time I knew, there was a guy at the school I went to, full of lousy teachers. This guy was one of them. His name was Dunn. And I wrote a song, I wrote the poem called The Floods Roll On. And I took it in. I knew it was good because I'd tried to write. I'd been a 12, something like that. I was really proud of it. And he got really angry. He said, you've stolen this. That was like the biggest compliment anybody could ever pay you. To tell a 12-year-old he'd stolen, you know, a poem. And then it went blank for a while, but then when I got back in, I was a bass player, semi-pro and all the rest of it, but then I started writing again as I was in, you know, semi-pro bands as a bass player. And when I joined Mott, Pete and Mick, the bass player and the lead guitar player, Mick Ralphs and Pete Watts, they were the two writers. But Pete was a real good-looking bloke and was concentrating on models at the time. And so slowly I became a co-writer with Mick Ralphs. And that's when it started, you know, the beginning of March. I had actually been for a year with Francis Day and Hunter, which was a publishing company in London. And I had a couple of singles out, Dave Berry, Niall, and, I don't know, some actor. They had me on £15 a week. So I got out of the factory. That's how I got out of the factory. And about a year after I started with Farson's Day and Hunter, I got the call from Mott.
Now, what made you pick up an instrument at first? You know, you always sit there like, I grew up with a family. My dad played the saxophone. My sister actually played the French horn and cello. My brother played the drums. I sucked at all instruments, so I knew not to play. But what made you pick up an instrument, and what were some of your earlier influences?
My dad's brother gave me a guitar. It was kind of like a bow and arrow. He was cool. My dad was a policeman. He was dead against it. My mum was your average nice mum, you know, good mum. My dad wouldn't have it. He wouldn't let me rehearse in the, you know, if you rehearsed in pubs, get out, because he was a policeman. And you had to leave, basically. I left when I was 16. And I went to a place called Butlins, which is a holiday camp in England for working class. And I met a couple of guys there that lived in Northampton. And they played instruments. And by this time, I knew CF&G. And so I hung out and did Blue Moon with them. And we won this talent competition. That resulted in me leaving home, and then moving to Northampton and hanging out with these people. And that was a lot nearer London. You know, Shrewsbury was 260 miles from London. Now I'm in Northampton. That's 60 miles from London. I'm on the way.
Isn't it weird how when you're even if you're far away, when you're creative, you know, you have to gravitate to a city. So when you get in London, how did you end up getting into London?
Oh, it's difficult because, you know, everything. If an orange was six, you know, an orange was like 10 cents in Northampton, it was 25 cents in London. And, you know, that applied to rent, everything. And, you know, I was still working in factories and all that. But somehow I got down there and £2.10 a week. It's about $5 a week. Living in Archway. Actually, about a couple of blocks from where John Lydon began. And I was there and I met a guy called Miller Anderson who lived on the next street. And we used to go to auditions together. And that way I found a place called Regent Sound in the West End, run by a guy called Bill Farley. And he was kind of like Sun Studios in Memphis. A lot of people, you know, Hendrix rehearsed there. Little Richard rehearsed there. It was a little four track, but it was a cool place to be. And it was Bill Farley who ran that place that rang me up about the mock gig, because they were in there auditioning people. And I, two buses from the Archway to the West End, and they were both on time. And I got there in half an hour and got the job.
Now, how does things start changing for you when you get the job with Mott? I mean, all of a sudden, do you think you guys are going to do really well, or what was your mindset?
15 quid a week, which was what Francis Day and Hunter had been paying me. I just said, I can't do this. You know, I had responsibilities at the time. I'd married young, I had two kids, and, you know, you've got to pay the alimony and all that kind of stuff. And the band weren't convinced. Guy Stevens, straight away, liked what I was doing. Because I was a bass player, you know. I mean, I played them a bass solo, and they were horrified. And then I sat down and played the... it was either like a Rolling Stone or Laugh at Me, the Tony Bono song, I forget which. And Guy Stevens went nuts. But the band were not too sure about it at all. And by the time Guy wasn't too sure about it, we were 9 months in, and then the band were sure about it. So the first 9 months were really dodgy. Then I started sort of writing stuff, and things took their natural route.
Now, I always wonder this. How does one learn how to be a front man for the band? Because it's one of the most dynamic jobs, and you have to have charisma, especially back then. It was such a great time of frontman. But was it just instinct that made you good? And what made you put on the sunglasses? I mean, what made you a good frontman?
Well, the sunglasses were, I had weak eyes. This was before, I'd always wore shades in the summer and all the rest of it. I used to squint all the time. So that was that. As far as front man was concerned, when I joined Mott, I was on piano. I was on the left-hand side. And Farley, the organ player, was on the right-hand side. And the other guys were in the middle. And Guy Stevens started playing up the manager. You know, he said, you know, we need somebody at the front. Because Guy was a Stones fan. And I could play a few chords and that. One night we were playing at a place called Letchworth Youth Club. And I was singing, and the spotlight wasn't on me. It was on Nick, the guitar player, and I stopped the song, and I said, you know, the spotlight's not on me, and I'm singing this. Will you redirect this spotlight? And I was fully expecting a chorus of booze, but the opposite happened. And I was like, oh, you can actually run this thing as opposed to, you know, just sit here. And I got more and more arrogant. And Jerry Lee Lewis, I suppose. I was a big fan of Jerry Lee, and he was arrogant, you know. And there's a certain amount of leadership and arrogance you need when you're a front man, because you're really running the show, you know what I mean? Audiences are there to be, you know, ran, I mean, they're there for being to be entertained, but it's kind of like soccer. You know, you're a fan. They're on. You're not. If soccer players come near you, they're going. You're not. You're sitting there. So you back off. So there's a kind of weird kind of dichotomy about front men. You know, you either can do it or you can't. I found out I could.
Well, it's funny you said about the arrogance, because I always say, like, as comedians, we're part narcissistic and we're part insecure, and that's why it works, because we crave the limelight, but then we also want the limelight. It's probably a lot like being a front man, because you have to have an arrogance, because if you don't, the crowd's not going to buy into you.
No. I relaxed with it. I mean, it was pretty quick. I must have an ego, you know. I mean, when he actually did it the first couple of times, it was scary. But then I realized, you know, yeah, okay, they're fine. You know, I can react with these people. And I used to talk, and it was okay, you know. The last 20 years I stopped talking. I just, you know, play the songs. But in the old days, you know, I mean, talking on all the young dudes, the back end. That's me. That was me talking from a gig the night before, you know.
Now, I'm always fascinated with musicians from England and over the UK about Top of the Pops. Now, you played, what did Top of the Pops mean? I know you played, you Mott did it. How big was that for someone back then? Like, was that when you knew you made it?
It was a horrible TV show. But if you were sitting at 12 in the charts, go on there, you were going to be in top five. It was as simple as that. And so, you know, more or less forced by the label, you know, get it on there. And you did. And it was a horrible day. Nobody liked doing it. I mean, your wives had to dance or they weren't allowed in the studio. That, you know, it was really... And then you go to the bar, you can't come in here, you know, and then you go for a walk and then you go back and you go to the bar. You can't come in here. Go for a walk, go back to the bar. Yeah, okay, you can come in here. There's no logic with it. It was just an all day of misery. But yeah, it did the trick.
Now, all the young dudes, you know, iconic song. You originally, you turned down Suffragette City. And why did you do that? Is it just because you felt it wasn't ready? And looking back, do you think you made the right choice? Do you think that would have been as big as All the Young Dudes?
No. I think we did make the right choice. I think we had good songs. It's just we'd had a couple of stiffs on the radio, so you know how it is. I mean, you're not going to get played unless you come along with something special. So, you know, Suffragette was... We were writing songs as good as Suffragette, but we weren't writing songs as good as All the Young Dudes, you know. And when I heard that, it was like, I know I can sing it. I know it's a hit. And that's how that came about.
So how does your life change when you have a hit? As a musician, does it give you an added bit of confidence? Or is it a little bit scary because you know you're going to have to at least equal that down the road?
Well, you know, David had written it. So now are we David's boys or are we Mott the Hoople? Press can be pretty cruel that way, you know. Oh, yeah, as long as they get somebody else to write the song, you know. So there was a frantic 9-month period where Mick Ralph and myself were trying to write a follow-up. And I got on a roll. I got like 4 in a row, I think it was, after that. And one of them, you know, sold more than Dudes did. But Dudes were special. Dudes represented something, you know. It wasn't just a hit song. It was something else. So really, we were lucky in a way that to this day, he gave it us.
You said it. What did it represent to you? And what did it represent to the people at the time? What did Dudes represent?
I don't know. I mean, it was an interesting... Johnny Depp rang me a couple of days ago, and he said... You said, I'm a dude dad, and that's what got me. And I'd never thought about it like that. The word dad, I'm a dude dad. Was this, you know, I don't know if it was a David or if I shoved it in. But when you think about it, it's like this kid's talking to his father about all this stuff. That lyric is, it could be that, you know. Never dawned on me.
So after Mott, why did Mott break up? What happened? Why did you leave the band? What and decide to go? Because you've recorded so many damn solo albums. It's just, it amazes me when you look. It's like over 20 of them. But what made you decide to go on your own?
I really, what had happened was we got Ronson in the band, Nick Ronson, and he didn't get on with a couple of the guys. For various reasons, it wasn't Mick's fault, it was Mick's manager's fault, Tony DeFries. Mick was on a different deal, and Mick had a different car, and I didn't care, it didn't bother me, we had a great guitar player, but it bothered a couple of guys in the band. And so in the end, it got so stupid, I just like, it's a toss-up. I don't think I can write in this situation anymore. But I could write with Mick Ronson, and so I left, and Mick left a week later, and we just carried on, the two of us.
You know, everybody speaks so highly of Mick, and you had a special relationship with him. What made him so special? And then what made it that you guys just clicked so well? Was there a certain chemistry, or what was it? I mean, what made him special, and why'd you guys click so well?
Well, when you're a songwriter, you're looking for an arranger, mainly. You're looking for a guy who's well into sound, because I'm okay with sound, but I'm not to that degree. Ronson was a great producer. He was a great arranger. He could play anything. You know, he played viola, cello. You know, he could give him Mick any instrument. It didn't matter what it was, he could play it. Just natural. And Andy York, the guy I'm with now, similar sort of situation. And as a writer, you need these people. You know, they're going to enhance what you do, and they're going to tell you, get rid of that. Don't do this. Why don't you change it there? You know, take the bridge out. Why don't you edit it? Why, it's too long, you know, all that kind of stuff. You need a good partner like that. And Mick was fantastic. Thing with him was, they were my songs. And people get bored doing other people's songs. So Mick would go off and play with other people, you know. And so for 20 years, it was kind of on and off. We'd do a tour, we'd do a record, and then off he went. And then he'd come back a couple of years later, maybe 3 years later, 4 years later. And we were best mates. Our wives were best mates. And the kids grew up. And, yeah, it was 20 years with Mick. It was a great friendship.
Now, when you went on your own, was it hard for you to get a record deal for that first album, Ian Hunter? Or did you get it because people knew you had a proven track record?
What they said was, look, you know, this is, you're going to go down 2/3 in sales. Which I did. but no, I didn't have a problem. Later on, I had problems because I did an album called All American Alien Boy, which wasn't what was expected of me. So from then on in, I had problems. But at that point in time, no. I put out the first album. I think we had a hit in England. Yeah, we had a hit in England, once bitten. Big hit over here later on with somebody else. So, yeah, the first album, great, you know. But then DeFries messed me. He got in between me and Mick. And so now I'm on my own. And that's where Jocko Pastorius came in and people like that. And I did All American Alien Boy, which was a really good album, but kind of sunk the pop career.
What is that like when, I mean, I always try to think, when musicians, you said it was a really good album, but it sunk your pop career. What is that like when you know that it's really good work, but then, you know, like people don't, you know, the executives are like, it's not the sound we want from you. Is that hard as an artist? Because you want to be true to yourself, but then you also want to create something that's going to make you money.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, you're pissed because you know it's good. But what it is like John Elliott said, you know, I'm used to you doing rock and roll. All of a sudden I get confronted with this. I don't know what it is. I don't like it. Now I like it. But at the time, you know, I wasn't used to this. And that was the typical, you know, kid reaction to it. And so to make up for that, I did a lousy record, trying to get back to rock and roll. And then I did a great one. I did Schizophrenic.
Schizophrenic's great. I want to ask you, you said you did a lousy record. What is it, did you know when you were recording it that it was lousy? I mean, was your heart just not into it, but you knew you had to probably do something like this for career longevity?
It was just getting back into rock and roll. I just must have panicked or something, you know, like, because All American Alien Boy had just died on me. Oh, I better get back to doing rock and roll, you know. So I guess I just rammed through this album, and it was nobody's fault but my own. And some people like it, I don't like it. But then Schizophrenic, you know, that was where I calmed down and got back to actually finding a bit of both. A bit of, you know, growing up sort of record it was.
Well, with Schizophrenics, I remember that. I still remember because that was, you know, that started playing in the Philadelphia radio. And I still remember the album cover. And I still remember the title because, you know, it is that people, it's just a title that stuck with you.
Now,
originally, is it true that you gave Mick Ronson, he saw that and you gave him writing credits or something to get it?
Yeah, he saw it on a toilet wall, and he told me, so I got this great title for the next record, you know, because he was writing his own records as well. And I said, yeah, what's that? You're Never Alone with Schizophrenic. I think he found it off a wall in the Power Station, which was a studio in New York, and that's where we were. And I said, I've got to have that title, Mick. I have to have it. So in the end, I gave him a song, half a song, called Just Another Night. That was the deal.
Now, Cleveland Rocks, of course, you know, it has gotten second life from the Drew Carey show and the sports teams and all that. But originally it was called London Rocks, England Rocks, right?
No. Originally it was Cleveland Rocks. I don't know where people get this from when they come up with dates and all the rest of it. I know. I wrote it.
Right.
I know who wrote it. I know what the piano I wrote it on. It was Cleveland Rocks, and later on we were short of a single in England, and they said, you know, we think this could be good if it was England Rocks instead of Cleveland Rocks. And I said, oh, okay, fine. And it's slightly different, you know, there's an orchestral bit on the back end, but it was Cleveland Rocks, and that's from the person who wrote it.
Now why'd you choose Cleveland, and did you have a special relationship with that city?
Yeah, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, all these places that were, you know, I mean, like Cleveland especially, I mean, the talk show hosts used to take the piss out of Cleveland, you know, it was, and we were like, well, they're not catching up with us in New York or LA, you know, they're catching up with us in Detroit, they're catching up with us in Cleveland, places off the beaten track. Cleveland was actually a pretty hip place, and so that's why I wrote it. You know, MMS was a great radio station. Kid Leo was the big DJ. Rock had started there. Rock radio.
Now, what was your thoughts of America when you were touring, when you were young? Did you like playing in America, or did you like playing more in your homeland, or what did you prefer?
I liked America because the hotels were bigger, cleaner. You know, it was always, everything was bigger. Yeah.
So you're going after Schizophrenic. It's a big hit. What do you start focusing on? What kind of music do you want to focus on after that? Do you want to stick with the same stuff, or do you want to experiment more like you did before? Or what's your focus?
Well, Mick and I toured that one, and that was good because he was no longer with the Fleas, so we had that out of the way. And so then we went. When we finished touring, we were tired. We didn't know what to do, you know. And I'd written songs, but they were kind of patchy. And one of them was called Theatre of the Absurd, and it was kind of reggae-based. And so Mick Jones was around. Mick Jones, out of Clash, had been a fan of Mott all the way through. So I talked to Mick about producing. Well, he came in for Theatre of the Absurd. And we did that track, and then he kind of took over, which was great because me and Mick were tired. And we did this we did this album, you know, Short Back and, what was it? Short Back and Sides, I think it was. And it was kind of odd. Lots of different strange noises on and all that kind of stuff. It was, we liked it. We enjoyed it.
Now, you mentioned... Your manager hated it? Why?
It didn't ring me for a month. I said, what's the matter? You know, like, you don't like the new record? He said, I fucking hate it. Steve Popovich. Cleveland man.
So I want to ask you, you know, Once Bitten, Twice Shy. It was you mentioned earlier, it was remade But what is it like when someone remakes your song? Like, do you sit there and listen to it and go, yeah, ours was better? Or do you just say, screw it, I don't even want to hear it?
Well, the latter. But more power to them, you know. I mean, sold a couple of million. I'm getting paid for this, you know what I mean? So I'm eternally thankful to them for that, as I am Mallow, you know. Different neck of the woods, you know. But yeah, what's wrong with that? I always think it's great if somebody covers it.
You know what's fascinating? If someone found a time capsule and they played all the young dudes and they said, the gentleman who you know, sang the song, and they played other songs, you know, Cleveland Rocks and all that, and they said, oh, and by the way, Barry Manilow sang one of his songs, they wouldn't believe you.
Yeah. Well, Barry Manilow's different neck of the woods, you know, but he's a great arranger. He did all that middle stuff. Who am I to argue with that? You know, the guy knows what he's doing.
Now, through your career, what have you loved about being on the road? Because you know it is exhausting, and I was on the road as a comic, and it doesn't even compare to what musicians go through, because you guys do sound checks. We just pop into the show and drive from town to town. But what did you love about being on the road? Was it the decadence, or was it just the experience of just seeing fans adore you? I mean, what is it that keeps people on the road after a long time? Because a lot of times you burn out.
Camaraderie. I've always had bands. I mean, Mott was an odd band. It was an eccentric band. It was, always called them the Hereford Mafia. I was the odd one out. But they were strange, and they all had the weird eccentricities, so it was always interesting. And all the bands that I've had have been great. Great fun. Comedians, you know. And to me, camaraderie is the big one. The traveling, forget it, you know. And the gigs kind of, you know, you get blurred. For me, the personalities and the people I've worked with, the bands that I've had and stuff like that, that's the big one for me.
Now, I mentioned I saw you at the amphitheater with Ringo. What's it like when you play in a band like that? Because that was such a, his all lineups, that is such a talented lineup. It had Greg Lake, it had Roger Hodgkins, it had Sheila E. Howard Jones. Is that something that, do you feel when you're playing with other people at your level, that you have to bring it up a notch because it's...
I was a bit scared, you know. I mean, I came home one day and Ringo was on the answering machine. You know, hello Ian, do you want to be in the band? I was like, whoa, a Beatle. So yeah, I mean, it was a bit scary at first, you know. But it was great. It was a great experience. Everybody was, there was no stupid, there was no ego, nothing like that. It was good fun, the whole thing.
Now, you've released a lot of albums, and like any in anyone's career, there's ups and downs. Has there ever been a point where you just wanted to say, screw it, I'm done with the music industry, I'm done performing? Or have you always sat there and just said, this is what I do, and I'm not going to ever turn my back on it?
Well, yeah, I stopped for 7 years at one point, which is annoying, you know, because I started up again when I was 50. This is not a good idea. I'm not one of those that can do album. I can't write on the road for a start, you know, so that's difficult. I mean, some people, Ray Davies could write on a plane. That's what he had to do. Gave up. 80s I hated, because that's when the corporations, this industry makes money. We'll take them all over. So what do? They buy all the radio stations. And now we've got, because they don't know what to play, because they've got to get these experts to tell them what to play. So now we're hearing Stairway to Heaven 30 times a day, no matter where you look, from one guy in Atlanta. All the regional music's disappearing. You know, it's just becoming one big corporate mess. I hated that, and so did Ronald. I stopped for a few years. I just thought, it's over. This stinks. This is awful. But then, you know, it's what I do. So, you know, I did an album called Ramped. That's how I came back. A guy called Steve Holly, a drummer. Steve was with the Wings. He rang me up. He was in New York, and he said, you know, you should be doing something. And we went to a charity gig, and Andy York played there. And I just thought, Andy's, that guy is amazing. Unfortunately, he's with John Mellencamp. So I'm the in-betweener. And that's how it's been since 2020. And we've been pretty regular. But the years before that, after Mick died in 92, right through to 2000, 8 years probably, I wasn't doing anything.
So I want to get back to Defiance Part 2. As I said, I really enjoyed it. And I've learned, you know, I judge albums now how if I can listen to them when I'm on the treadmill. And if they keep me interested, because I hate the gym, I listen to them. I want to ask you, are you a big weed advocate? Because you wrote the song Weed. Tell me the story behind Weed.
Weed is actually not what you think at all. If you really have a good look at the lyric, you'll find it's the completely opposite of what people think it actually is. And I ain't about to explain it.
Okay. Well, off the new album, what are your favorite tracks? I mean, do you as a performer, you know, you have this album with a bunch of songs. Do you sit there and choose and say to yourself, this is one of my favorites, or do you just say they're all great?
Well, this one is pretty even all the way through. The last one, I thought a couple of songs stuck out, you know, but this one. You know, with songs that are like kids, you don't really want to differentiate and say one song's better than another. You know, if they're like kids, you feel bad. I'm happy with every track that we did, including, you know, the bonus ones. They're fine.
Now, how important is to put a good order of songs? How do you adjust? How do you decide what's going to go where? Because I grew up from the album generation, and you remember side one had this song, and it went chronological. It just sounded right. Does it take a lot of thought process to sit there and say, we're going to start with this song, we're going to put this song fifth, we're going to put this one eighth?
Just Andy York and myself, you know, he'll probably list it, and then we'll argue, and then we thought we'd wind up with the track listing. The last one was easier. This one was harder. This one's very even, you know, so it's harder.
Now, is there still more music in you? Do you plan to keep writing? Because, you know, you've had these two albums come out, and it's a lot of, I mean, it's, as you said, you take your time to write. What is your future plan? I mean, do you sit there and feel like you have more songs in you?
Yeah. That's what I do. Same as what you do. You're not my age, but you'll find when you're my age, that's what you'll be doing.
Well, I hope so. I hope I can be as prolific as you when I'm your age. I mean, I'm losing my shit, and I just turned 60.
So
I want to ask you. You know, I always give me what are a few things that have made you proud about your career when you look back? You know, I talked to an actor a few weeks ago, and he said he was very proud because acting. He got to pay his kids' college through his acting career, and that made him very proud. What are a few things that make you proud when you look back at your career? Because it's been a great career, but what's some things that make you proud?
Nothing, really. None of my kids went to college.
But really, no, there's got to be something you look back and go, this was all worthwhile. This is just, I've had a great career.
I don't know. I mean, I just take it. I never really thought about it. I mean, when I was young, I was a huge fan. And I never thought I'd get into it to be a pro, to actually make money out of it, let alone, you know, a fair few bob at it. But I don't really think in terms of pride or proud. It's just what I do, and you get lucky now and again, you know.
So give me a good story. Give me a good rock and roll story, Ian. You've had a great life. Give me a good rock and roll story that I can hear and go, man, I wish I went into music instead of comedy.
I don't know. You'd have to tip me. I mean, there's so many of them that you'd have to give me some kind of tip.
Okay, give me a story when you were a young man on the road, and some of the decadence that went on.
Decadence. Everybody thought because Mother Hoople was Mother Hoople, you know, the name, especially in San Francisco, that kind of deal. They thought when we were actually on Pale Ale, you know, we were miles behind when it came to all the dope and all the rest of it. And the decadence, I don't know. I never saw much of it. But then again, I'm not a lady's, you know, I'm not God's gift to women, you know, I'm just an average looking guy. With Ronson, however, I mean, you know, there'd be a girl outside the elevator upstairs, there'd be a girl outside the elevator downstairs, there'd be a girl outside the room, there'd be a girl, you know, when you went in for your breakfast. He was kind of used to that, you know. But Mick just liked pulling in. Decadence, I don't know.
We always hear, like, that time, like, all your bands were, like, out of control. It was the golden day of rock and roll.
Yeah, but they were nice. They were nice. We had riots, but they were nice riots. They weren't horrible riots. They were. They were really nice. I mean, a bloke in Newcastle brought out German Shepherds, you know, because he thought he had a bad riot, you know. Like, whoa, 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 you know, like, take them dogs away. This is just people having a good time.
I have one final question for you. Do you remember the first time you heard your voice singing on the radio?
The only time I remember actually being shocked was we had a song on the first album, I forget the name of it. It was long. It was a very long song. I was in the West Village in New York, which was all new to me, you know, like, brilliant to be in New York. And in those days, I don't know if you remember, they used to have little pockets that you could put on the crossbar of your bike, and there'd be a radio in it. I'm walking down Bleecker, and a guy came past on his bike, and the little thing, you know, the little radio on his crossbar was playing Half Moon Bay. And that was like, whoa. That was such a buzz.
Well, this
here I'm walking around Bob Dylan territory, listening to one of our songs. You know, this was a big deal.
Well, that's awesome. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me. People, go to this website. It's ianhunter.com. And you got to pick up the new album, Defiance Part 2, Fiction. You're going to enjoy it. So please check them out. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find over 1,005 episodes there. You can also email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Facebook, it's Cooper Talk Radio. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.